Hey, hey, my fellow dream chasers, it's Princess Fizz here. Welcome to another episode of I Have a Dream Show, bringing you multimillionaires from around the world to hear their unique journeys to success, great business wisdom, free mentoring and inspiration. Now, if you're looking to boost your online presence as a small business owner and stand out from the noise, you have to check out my free 10-day course on how to create an amazing web TV show or podcast for any industry. Go to becomeamediapreneur.com and get instant access to the course, and I'll get you ready for launch within 10 days. If you've seen my web TV shows and love my makeup, check out Moonstruck 3D Fiber Lashes, which is the best-selling product by Unique, at ihaveadreamshow.com/beauty. And if you prefer to watch the video shows, then you can go to ihaveadreamshow.com/shows, where there's a library of all the I Have a Dream shows to date. So now take out your notepads and enjoy the show.
I'm just so, so excited. Can you see it in my voice? I'm just so... please welcome Ryan Levesque, coming in live from America. Thank you so much, Ryan. You're one of my favorite entrepreneurs right now. Thank you for joining the I Have a Dream show today.
Well, Princess Fizz, the feeling is mutual. You are one of my favorite hosts. So I'm so thankful to be here. I feel like you have such great energy, this such amazing show, and I'm just thrilled to be back here with you.
It's brilliant. I mean, if you've been following my shows, guys, Ryan has been on before, and he came onto my marketing university. So I'm going to attach that particular class after the show, so you can actually see in depth his level of expertise when it comes to surveying, right? So we're going to talk about that on the show as well. So if you're struggling on, if you've got lists and things and you don't know how to communicate with them, then stay tuned. We're going to give you lots and lots of information about that. But sponsors of the show, guys, it's Unique, the makeup I'm wearing now, so check out the link below. And it's Lead Pages as well, so they're like a software for capture pages and, you know, to help you build that. So it's a great marketing tool. Check those links. But oh my God, Ryan, I mean, wow. So tell me about you. I mean, I know you were working in Wall Street as a salesperson. Should we start from there, or should we go back a bit? What inspired you to be? You were an employee at that time, right? Were you an entrepreneur before that, or did something happen that turned you into an entrepreneur? What happened?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and so again, just really thrilled to be here. Yeah. So thank you. To answer your question, so about the Wall Street thing, at that point I was an employee. So I think it might make sense to go just maybe a little bit before then, just to kind of to set the stage. Yes. So I'm someone who grew up, and I grew up in a pretty what we call a blue collar background here in the United States, working class background. I was the first person in my family ever to go to university, and growing up in high school, I worked three jobs. I was a janitor at our high school, which is, do you have that term in the UK? Janitor? Toilets, wash floors, everything like that. It was actually a pretty decent paying job for a high school student. And high school for us is, do you call it? Yeah, you don't call it high school. What do you call it? Secondary school?
College, secondary school, yes.
Yeah, so basically when you're like 13 to 18. Yes, so yeah, 13 to 18 years old. So worked as a janitor with my best friend, and my best friend and I, we had a landscaping business. So to answer your question, was I an entrepreneur? So we were mowing lawns, trimming hedges, you know, tending to gardens, and doing that thing.
Why though, Ryan? Why were you doing that? I mean, why not just play games and do what the normal people do? Why be entrepreneur? Why work?
It's a great question. I think, so while my parents are both working class, never went to college, they both had very strong work ethic. Oh, right. For example, my mom, she cuts hair for a living. She's a hairstylist, a barber. And to make extra money for us as kids growing up, she would start work at 5 in the morning.
Right.
Because there are certain professions like teachers who would come to get their hair done before class. And in the States, school starts at like 7:30. So they would come, get their hair done before class, and then go to work. So she'd start at 5 a.m. Yes. And for me, growing up, her little hair salon was just one room in our basement. It was one room in the basement of our house where she would cut hair, and no windows or anything in the room. And so people would come to our house. And we lived kind of in the country. And so if someone was coming to get their hair done at 5 a.m., and growing up in the state of New Hampshire, which is notorious for our brutal winters, that meant that Ryan and my sister, we were all up at 4 a.m.
Right.
Shoveling the driveway.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I said to myself,
that's a lot of discipline, isn't it, at that time? And I think maybe I feel that your mum would probably make you work for stuff as well.
Yeah, we didn't have anything growing up. I mean, we had to work, even as young kids, we had to work 4 hours every day before we could start playing. So 4 hours could be, vacuum the house, tend to the garden, anything like that. And we had our list of acceptable work. And we didn't get paid for this. This was just like, you're an employee of the house type thing. So I didn't have anything grow up, did everything myself. And for me, that created a tremendous amount of motivation that I don't ever want to have to do that. And I tell people, and I've said this in interviews before, that I work really hard so I can be lazy.
Excellent.
So today, the antithesis is I have someone who cooks all of our food. We have someone who cleans our house. I have a handyman. We have people who clean our cars. We have, everything like this that I had to do as a kid growing up. I never want to have to do that again. And so I know what that's like. I know what it's like waking up, having to go to school, and 2 hours before you go to school, shovel 2 feet of snow in the morning at 4 a.m. so the customers can drive up the driveway and not be caught in snow. I know what that's like. So, and I never want to have to go back there. So I think that created, so to answer your question, why work all these jobs? I knew that the key, at least at the time, my thought was that the key was going to college.
Right.
That if you go to college, that's your ticket. That's your ticket out of that world. I did not want to be, my grandparents didn't graduate from high school. So they dropped out of school when they were like 16. My parents were the first to get through high school. And I wanted to be the first to go to college. And I knew that that was a monumental step up. Now, what I wanted to study, I had no idea. I thought I was going to become a doctor. I thought I was going to become a neuroscientist. That's what I studied in school, is neuroscience. And what was a big deal for my family, so not only, so coming of this background, it was a really big deal not only to go to college, but for me, I went to, in the States, we have their 8 Ivy League schools. So this is Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Dartmouth, Columbia, Cornell, what else am I forgetting? One more, and then Brown. And these are largely regarded as it's kind of like Oxford and Cambridge, exactly. And so they're extremely selective. When I applied to Brown, I think the acceptance rate was between 8% and 10%.
Right.
90% of people who apply flat out rejected. Right. And not only did I get in, I got in early, which is even more difficult to get into. And so I got in early my senior year, and it was just a huge deal.
Yes.
Because it was a big deal. It was a big deal in our family. I mean, it was it was so unexpected.
Yes.
But on the flip side is that it creates all these expectations, right? Because like now it's like, family puts their heart and soul and all of the hopes and dreams are like in you. So it's like, oh my gosh, the weight of the world is on you. You got to do something. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. Like, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought I was going to become a neuroscientist. I studied neuroscience. And then at Brown, I realized that there was a difference between, I say this, there's between smart and really smart. And I was smart, but not really smart.
Right.
And I learned that because, in part, my best friend in college, who was my roommate, he and I took a lot of the same classes. He was in neuroscience with me. And I just saw how things came to him in a way that it didn't come to me. Like, I got through everything in my life up until that point by just hard work, like really hard work, right? All through high school, worked 3 jobs, was the janitor, had the landscaping business. I was also what we call a cashier at the grocery store. I worked a lot. I would stay up till, 2 in the morning to work on homework.
Tell me something. What's actually going on when you are working hard? Because you're putting a lot of energy in. It's yep. Like, scientifically, tell me what is going on when it comes to even connections with the universe. You know, when you give
yep.
yourself as right. energy to the universe, because you're giving that energy, right? When you work hard, you're doing stuff.
Right.
So you're taking action. What's actually going on versus someone that just sits still on a couch?
I mean, I say this, and it's like, this is truly the honest answer. The only way I've known how to be successful at anything that I've done has been truly just to put 100% of myself into it. Just dive all the way in. And when I haven't done that, when I've kind of taken half measures, I've always failed. And so there are people listening to this that are probably much smarter than I am that say, well, no, there's an easier way to do that. I truly, and this goes to the whole marketing approach, which, you know, it's all about doing things that I know that most people aren't willing to do, right? Yeah. Most businesses are just, they're not willing to do it. So I know that if I just do that, that for me, I take a tremendous amount of solace in that, that I know that if I just do what everybody else is not willing to do because it's too much work, that's going to be successful. And that's proven time and time again. When I learned to speak Chinese nearly fluently, and I did a program, an intensive program in China. And it was a program run by Princeton University. And it's a program where you sign a pledge and you can only speak Chinese. Like, you cannot speak any English, you cannot read any English books. If they hear a word of English, you're actually kicked out of the program.
Yes.
And I, when I went to that program, I tell this story. I had studied 2 years of Chinese at Brown, okay? And in this program, it was the summer after my third year in university. So I should have been into the third year level program.
Right.
2 years of university, so you go into the third year program. Now I get to this program and they make you take this entrance exam. They make you take a test to gauge what your level's at. It's kind of mostly a formality, right? And so I go through this test and I take the test, and then at the end they have you know, they put your names up on a wall, they have everybody's name up at the list, like what level you're in. And for the most part it's like, okay, yeah, you expect it. And then there were a couple names, my name wasn't on the list.
Right.
And I'm looking for it, and eventually I get a tap on the shoulder, and the director of the program says, can you come in my office?
Wow.
And it's me and these two other girls.
Uh-huh.
And he has them come in, and it's this panel of teachers inside his office, and I'm like panicking now, like what did I do wrong? It's like the first day of class, and they're gonna kick me out, you know? I'm panicking, and they said, you're here because your levels are unexpected based on where you think you should be. And the first two girls were both American-born Chinese, and so their verbal Chinese was almost fluent, but their written Chinese was a little bit kind of weak. And they were actually in higher levels than they thought. So they bumped them up. So they let the first two girls go. And then it's just me. And they said, Ryan, you know, you think you should be in third year Chinese, but you tested at second year.
Right.
And I'm thinking, that can't be. I already took 2 years of Chinese. This would be like remedial. It'd be like taking the class again.
Yes.
And they said, so what we want to do is we want to hear you speak a little bit to see if we can, you know, justify putting you in the third year class.
Wow.
And at this point, I'm like, I'm feeling so stupid.
Yes.
I'm thinking like, what did I do? I just spent 2 years of, I mean, you know, Brown is like, at the time, was like $40,000, $50,000 a year, $100,000 of education. You're telling me a year was a waste?
Wow.
And so I'm in this room, I'm panicking. And long story short, they let me in, but just barely. They let me into third year Chinese. But it had this impression on me forever. And I said, well, I'm the worst kid in the class. I'm like the kid who barely made it in. There's like 40 people in the class. I'm number 40.
Right.
And I said, you know, I won't swear on your show, but I said, screw this. I'm going to be the best. And I don't care what it takes. And so what I did is I just worked. I outworked everybody in the program. And I said, you know what? If there's office hours, I'm going to spend every minute in those office hours with those teachers. And I don't care if those office hours go to 10. And weekends, I'm going to do bonus time with the teachers. I'm going to study in my spare time. I'm going to spend every minute. When kids were out partying and doing whatever and spending time, I said, well, I don't care. I'm going to do whatever it takes.
Right.
And I didn't finish as the top kid in the class. But I will tell you this. When I went back to Brown the next year, and I was known as like the kind of kid who had trouble, I come in the first day of class. So what happened is 2 years at Brown, did this intensive summer program in China. So that's my third year. So at Brown, you skip to fourth.
Right.
Year, right? So I'm in fourth year Chinese, and I'm with the kids that are, you know, all good. And first thing in class, the teachers asks everybody in class, you know, how was your summer? You know, what did you do? And everybody kind of responds. And then she gets to me. And this teacher, she was my first year teacher. She was the first teacher I ever had in Chinese. And she knew how bad I was. And I speak up in class, and her jaw hits the floor.
Whoa.
did one of them. And so then she's challenging me now. So she's asking me more detailed questions. And I'm just going boom, 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 boom. And we're having this conversation, fluent Chinese conversation, and everyone in the room, you could feel it, just kind of had one of these like
surreal moments. Like, what the heck just happened?
And that's when I knew it. I knew I'd achieved my goal, that I went from being the worst kid in the class to the best kid in the highest. And then eventually they took me out of that class and put me in an independent study because it was too basic. It was too easy for what I was doing.
So
the point is, what's the secret? Yeah. I don't have a secret. The secret is just you just buckle down and you work with this focus and determination. And that comes down to the clarity in your goals, singularity in your purpose. What is it that you really want to do? Focus on that one thing and make it happen. And we can talk about specifics, but that's been the story of everything that I've done in my life. And even right now, launching a number one bestseller,
yes,
and hitting number one on Amazon. What does it took? Well, singularity of purpose. And I have to be perfectly honest, because I'm not responsible alone for making that happen. We have a full team, and you've been part of that process to help, you know, the support to make that happen. And so it's a team effort. It's a big team effort. They say, I jokingly said, I even said this in the book, they say it takes a village to raise a child. It takes like a small city to launch a book like this. And that's really true. So I don't want to take the credits. It's really the credit of the team that deserves. But the point is, it's that singularity of purpose, focus, and determination.
So there's never, when people make a lot of effort and put a lot of energy and work and everything, and in between, they don't see anything really happening for them. Mm-hmm. Should they continue doing that? And is there ever like, you're doing it for nothing, or is it always an outcome for it? They should just carry on and keep the eye on the goal and keep your eye on the vision. And
there are low points. I'll talk about some, because the people, I think there's, and I tell people this, I think there's a mistake that we all make, and I've made the same mistake, and I think we all make it, is we look at where someone is and how they're acting after they've achieved a certain level of success.
Yes.
Whether it's a modest level of success like we're talking about today, or it's someone who's achieved profound success, mm-hmm, they see, okay, what is this person doing today? Because that's when everybody starts paying attention. Nobody pays attention to what they did in the 10 years that led to that overnight success.
Exactly, yes.
Right? And so that's the key. It's to go, okay, so it's to say, all right, well, I'm not there yet, but what was this person doing? How are they acting when they were in my situation? So let's talk about a couple low points.
Yes.
So we launched a business, one of our first businesses, and we talk about this in the book. It was in a tiny little obscure niche in the Scrabble tile jewelry market. We had an information product business teaching people how to make Scrabble tile jewelry. And I quit my job. This is when we're in China. So I worked on Wall Street, got a job because of my Chinese in China for company AIG. And in my mid-20s, I basically had this kind of quarter-life crisis. And I decided I don't want to do this. Like I have more in me. And I wrote this big, long, embarrassing letter. Have you gotten the book yet, by the way? Has it arrived to you?
I've got the chapters.
Okay, all right. So when you get the book, when it arrives to you, there's a full chapter.
Yes.
And it's this letter that I wrote to my mom.
Yes.
It was really a letter I wrote to myself, but I had to address it to someone. I had to share it with someone. It was really what was going on in my head. And it was this like super embarrassing, super personal letter. And I told my publisher about it. And he says, well, let me see the letter.
Okay.
And I like, I haven't looked at this thing since, and this was this year. Uh-huh. I haven't looked at this thing since 2007 or 2008 when I wrote it. So it's been on my heart. I'm like, I don't even know if I have it anymore. It's somewhere in a, I have an email that I sent to my mom, and let me see if I can find it. I dig up, it's an email address I'm not even using. I dig it up, I'm like, oh my God.
We try to get that as a bonus for you guys, right?
Yeah. And I said, he says, let me see it. And I send it to him. And he read it, and he comes back and he says, Ryan, this has to go in the book.
Wow.
Every struggling entrepreneur needs to read this letter. Because we've all gone through it. Everyone's gone through it before. And that was a low point for me. And I wrote this letter to my mom and I said, I don't know. I said, I have there's a fire in me. And I had this fire my entire life. But I had been working now for a little over half a decade after college. And I said, Mom, you know, I feel like this fire in me is about to extinguish. I feel like it's this flicker of a flame. And if I don't do something about it now, that's it. Like, I'm never going to do something about it. Right. And I said, you're going to think I'm crazy, but you're going to have, you have to trust me that this is the right decision. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. Within the next 6 months, I'm going to be quitting my job. Most people are going to think I'm crazy for what I'm going to be doing. It's going to be tough. This is probably going to be the toughest thing that I've ever done in my entire life, but I have to do this. And you might not believe in me. No one might believe in me, but I'm going to do this. And I did that. And my mom wrote, and she, you know, she wasn't supportive. she said, like, I was making a mistake. And that hurt. Like, it really hurt.
Because you were making good money in that job, weren't you?
Very good money. And I walked away from a lot more money because I had long-term compensation, you know, stock and stock options that hadn't yet vested that if I left that day, I would never see. So I walked away from all that. Golden handcuffs.
What was the emptiness? Why were you feeling that it's not fulfilling?
I felt like there was more in me. Like, I didn't feel like that was, I never use this word, but I'll use it now. I didn't think that was my destiny.
Right.
And you know me, like, I'm a pretty logical engineering type person. I'm not a heart centered entrepreneur, right? I'm not, that's just not, but so it wasn't my destiny. And I could feel like it wasn't, and I didn't know quite what was, but I knew it wasn't that. And the only person who believed in me was my wife.
Right.
That's it. She's the only person in the world. Everyone else said, dude, what are you doing? And my parents were like, what? You're leaving this high level executive job. You've got 24 people reporting to you. You've got this fancy office. You've got a car, a driver, a housekeeper. You're flying first class everywhere. You've got this fancy apartment. You've got all of these things. You're walking away from it to sell ebooks, teaching people how to make Scrabble tile jewelry. Like, what is that? And so in 2008, this was in the midst of the world financial crisis. I don't know if you remember, but Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, there are a bunch of companies in the financial space that went bankrupt.
Yes.
And I woke up one day, walked to my office. My apartment was a 10-minute walk to my office. Walked to my office, and I pick up the newspaper on my desk. And the front page of the newspaper read, the company I was working for, AIG, to file for bankruptcy.
The
Wall Street Journal. And I looked at it, and I, like, kind of had one of those moments where like it was a big gut check moment. And I called my wife and I said, go to WSJ.com, WallStreetJournal.com, go to WallStreetJournal.com, look at the front page, what does it say? And she looked at it and she said, whoa. And I said, I think it's the day. I think today is the day. And that day, I drafted up a resignation letter, walked into my boss's office, put it on his desk, and I said, I'm done. Here's my 2 weeks notice. I'm walking away.
The blessing then, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, it was the thing that I'm so thankful that happened. Now, I'm not thankful that it happened to AIG because so many of my friends and colleagues were affected. Ultimately, AIG emerged from it. The U.S. government bailed out AIG. They didn't have to go through bankruptcy, but at the time, it was very questionable. And I'm not thankful that it happened for that reason, but I'm thankful it happened on a personal level because it was the kick in the butt that I needed, where it was like, now. It was like something like a higher power saying, okay, like, hello, like, now.
Wake up.
So I did it. So I sold everything that I owned except for what I could fit into two suitcases, which wasn't very much. And at the time, my wife and I was based in Shanghai in this executive role, and my wife was pursuing a PhD at Hong Kong University in Hong Kong. So we were living this crazy bi-country marriage, and she's in like student accommodations. So here I am, pimped out a fancy apartment with all the trappings, and she's in a student apartment, and I sell everything. Well, I actually donated pretty much everything because he couldn't really sell much. I sold a few things, but donated everything. Two suitcases, move into a one-bedroom, 400-square-foot apartment, student accommodations with my wife. I bought a $450 laptop, and I just got to work. And so I then went full-time in this little Scrabble tile business that we had started. It was making a few thousand dollars a month, and I take this business working on it full time, almost to about $10,000 a month. And I'm thinking world domination. Like, we're gonna be, you know, maybe we're gonna go into all these different markets and we're gonna go, you know. And then, just like the world financial market crashed,
internet,
the Scrabble jewelry market crashed as well.
Right.
It was just a fad. And I didn't appreciate that, but everybody, people stopped buying the jewelry, therefore people stopped buying the tutorials on how to make the jewelry. And then we had one of these moments where we like looked at each other and we're like, oh crap. We didn't have any safety net now.
Right.
Like she was making, she had a $500 a month stipend. That was it. Like we were living on $500 a month. And so we had one of these moments, say, okay, what are we gonna do? And so she said, okay, well, I can get a job. Let's go back to the States. I'll get a job. I'll work full time. I'll make just enough money for us to get by, and you can work on the business. So we moved back to the States, and her background is in history and museum studies. Yes. So the, I don't know if you know this, but the museum world doesn't pay very well. So her job, she got a great job as a museum curator at a city in Texas,
right.
And her salary was $36,000 a year. And so we move back, and we buy one car. I drive her to and from work. We find the cheapest apartment in the city that doesn't have bars on the window. We have no furniture. So we open up a business bank account. I tell this story. The prize that we got for the opening of the business bank account was a like a lawn chair, like you see on the side of like a, you know, when children play football, soccer games, right? And they have like those little collapsible chairs. That was the prize. So my wife negotiates two. She convinces them to give us two. That's our living room furniture. So two of those little chairs in the living room. She gets out from work, and then she does second shift, and she works in the business with me. And so we're spending every single night stuffing envelopes with books and DVDs that we're selling. She gets out of work. We do that together. Go to the post office the next day, mail it out. During the day, I'm working on building the business. And I took that first business from nothing to $25,000 a month. Got it to a point that we're making enough money that she was confident, quit her job. We buy a house in Austin, Texas, which is about 500 miles away from this border city. We're living in the just right on the border, a mile away from the Mexican border, in a dirt poor city, Brownsville, Texas, one of the most inexpensive places to live and poorest places to live in the country. We move to Austin, which is like a hotbed of entrepreneurial activity. And then we launch another business using the same methodology that I teach in the book, and then just go into market after market after market after market. And I tell this story because I know what it's like to go through these lean times. Yeah. We lived on $50 a week in terms of our grocery budget. So we're eating frozen pizza, we're eating fast food, burgers once a week as our date night. We did a date night where there's this restaurant that did $1 hamburgers. We'd get three burgers, $3. That would be like our fancy date night out, just so we could do something. And we didn't spend money on anything. No new clothes, no entertainment, no movies, nothing.
A lot of sacrifices, no short-term pleasure. You were looking at the long-term thing, weren't you?
Yeah, and so the point is, it's important to hear that part of the story because people see, they see the article like a Business Insider making $5 million a year. They see the number one, New York Times, number one Amazon bestseller. They see, New York Times is our goal, the number one Amazon bestseller. They see these things and they think, oh, okay. But there's like a decade process to getting there. And there are people who are smarter than me that have been able to fast track it, but that's the true story. There's a lot of sacrifice and sacrificing the short term for those long term things.
Right. So, Ryan, it feels like you obviously were in a kind of desperate situation to make change. Do you think that helped you with procrastination and things like that? Because you've got no boss, you've got no one over you, your wife is kind of covering you. You know, as an entrepreneur, you can get a little bit like, just leave it for the next day kind of thing,
Totally.
How did you master that creativity that you need and the crafting that you need to really discipline yourself? Do you think it kind of fell into place? How did you do it?
It's a really good question. So like initially our goals, my goals are pretty modest. My thing was if we can make $20,000 a month. And I know for many people on this call, that number might seem like an unattainable goal for some people. That was my goal. That was like my ultimate vision. Like if I can make $20,000 a month, how could you ever want anything more? Like that's like the ultimate pinnacle. That's like if I could do that, then that's it. That's all I would ever possibly need. Well, you know what happens is like the horizon always changes. 20,000 becomes you know, 40,000, 40 becomes 100,000 a month, 100 becomes 200,000, 200 becomes 400,000. I mean, it just goes up. It's just what happens. The horizon is always distant. So, but we reach this level where we're making that kind of money, and finally things are comfortable. Like we're in a good position, right? We're not multimillionaires, but we don't want for anything. We have everything that we need. And then I did reach this kind of period of like, okay, well now what? Right. And this is shortly before our first son was born, about 3 years ago, and we reached this point. We were doing more than 20,000 a month at that point, considerably more. But we had reached kind of a level where I was like, okay, you know, all right, now what? And my son was born. And after my son was born, something strange sort of happened.
Right.
And I kind of was getting, I was really tired. And, you know, initially we chalked it up to the fact that anyone who has young kids on this call knows, like, all right, yeah. Young dad, young mom, you know, young kids, you're going to be tired. You're not going to get a lot of sleep. But this was kind of different. And I was tired, but I was also losing a lot of weight. And you see me now. I'm not a huge guy. I weigh about 170 pounds now. And my peak has been like 180 when I've really lifted. I had dropped down to about 130 pounds.
Wow.
So, and so I'd lost about 35 pounds, and I'm tired all the time. I'm thirsty all the time. And I just chalked it up to the fact that I was not getting a lot of sleep because of my young son, running this business that was growing really, you know, really well. And I'm exhausted. I didn't know we didn't attribute it to anything. And, my wife insisted that I apply for life insurance because we had a new son. So like, oh, you're dad now, you need to be responsible. Like, what if something happens to you? Like, you know, you need to protect us. So, you know, at her urging, I applied for life insurance, and this is in the summer of 2012. And so I apply for life insurance, and I go and if you've ever applied for life insurance, they send a medical examiner to your house. You do like a full exam. They take blood and work and everything like that. So send it off to the lab. Results fine. I go off to this conference, ClickBank Exchange, actually, in Manhattan at the Marriott Marquis in Times Square. And have this conference, and I met up with some friends of mine who I hadn't seen in a long time, and they all said, like, Ryan, are you okay? Like, you don't look good. And I kind of brushed it off. I'm like, you know, whatever. And then I get back, and I open up I get a bunch of mail. I get back from that trip, and I open up all my mail, and I have the letter from the life insurance company. I open it up, and the letter reads, it's a one-page letter, and there's, at the very top of it, it reads, denied.
Whoa, okay.
And I'm thinking, denied? That must be a mistake. Like, I'm a young guy in my 30s, pretty healthy. The only way you're denied from life insurance is, like, if you have, like, HIV or, like, terminal cancer or you're, like, on dialysis, like, something really serious. So I reach out to the life insurance agent. I call him up, and I said, I think there's a mistake. I think my letter must have gotten crossed with someone else's. Like, can you look into this? And he says, you know, Ryan, I think you need to sit down. And he says, I have a copy of your letter here. And I know you don't have it yet, but I also have a copy of your lab results. And he says, I'm not a doctor, but I think you should go see one. And I wouldn't put this off. And he gave me my lab results. He just read them to me over the phone. He said, I'll email you a copy of this in just a second, but just so you have it. And I started, you know, I made the mistake of Googling what these lab results meant. And the results that were coming up were kidney failure.
Goodness me, yes.
Renal system shutdown.
Wow.
Pancreatic cancer.
Wow.
All of these terrible things. My organs were shutting down. And so I'm freaking out. And I'm like, holy crap, what did I do to myself?
Yeah.
What did I do? And so, and later that night, I didn't tell my wife because I was like scared.
Yes.
And then later that night, my wife, we put our son to bed, and then casually she, you know, she said, like, hey, I saw the letter from the life insurance company, everything all set, like, we all squared away. And I said, well, I think we need to talk, honey. And I gave her the results, and she, you know, she like breaks down immediately. She's like bawling. She's looking it up, and she's mad at me. Like, that's the way she gets. She's like, what did you do? Like, you pushed yourself too hard. You know, you push your body to the max, you overdid it. And she's mad at me, but because she's scared too, and because she loves me. And she said, okay, like, we're going to the doctor's first thing tomorrow morning. Like, I don't care. She's like on top of it. And I'm kind of like still in denial. And she calls up the ask a nurse in the line. We get a doctor's appointment first thing next day, goes to the doctor. And like, I'm not one who goes to the doctor regularly. So the doctor didn't know me, you know, like, he's not like a regular doctor. He's like, yeah, you look, you're, you know, what's wrong with you? And I tell him the situation and he says, okay, well, let's do some lab results, but stay here. I'll do it stat, fast as we can get, stick around. And when he came out, his demeanor was like, he was a different person. He comes out and I remember it like it was yesterday. He grabs me by the shoulders and he says, and he's really slowly talks to me. He says, Ryan, you should be in a coma right now. You need to go to the emergency room. Yeah. You're not driving.
Mm. Oh, no, it's just...
And so my wife takes me there. We go. And it, the reason why I lost all the weight is because my body stopped. I couldn't metabolize food, so I was eating muscle tissue. It had been for months, and that's why I was losing all this weight. My kidneys were shutting down. I had blood in my urine. My pancreas completely stopped working, effectively. And I spent over a week in the ICU, intensive care, and the patients around me, I had terminal cancer patient on one side of me and the patient on dialysis on the other side of me, and here I am. And these are people who are like at the end of life. They're in their, you know, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and here I am. Young guy in his 30s on life support. And then I was, you know, you're there. My son was like 6 months old. And when you're in that situation, it makes you really come to terms with your own mortality. And you really ask yourself, all right, what am I going to do with my life?
Yes.
All right, I have a second chance now.
Yes.
And like, is this it? Am I going to make a bigger impact? And so... that's what it took to answer your question originally about not being complacent. That's what it took. I walked out of there. I fell into a state, for anyone who's curious, known as DKA, which is diabetic ketoacidosis, which is when your organs start shutting down. It's how children find out that they're juvenile diabetics, which you find out generally when you're a kid. Something happened in my body. We don't know what. It's a medical mystery today where I found out I'm a type 1 diabetic in my 30s. I'm not the first person on planet Earth for this to happen to, but it's extremely, extremely rare. And so my doctors have, we don't know. We don't know what did it, what set it off, why it happened. It's an autoimmune response. And so now my pancreas doesn't work. I have to take insulin injections. I'm very fortunate that we caught it when we caught it. It's the type of thing most people find out, they do slip into a coma. That's how you find out. They pass out when they're driving and then they... you know, get into a car accident or something like that. So life insurance and applying, my wife literally saved my life by making me apply for life insurance.
Yes, that's what I can see. I mean, the story is just absolutely amazing, Ryan. There's so much going on. If you analyze, you know, if you actually think about the whole dilemma of it, it's just amazing. It's like a wake up call in a way. It's like, you know, kind of going from one reality to another in a very extreme case, you know. I mean, when you were actually, you know, diagnosed, did you not have any, is your mind so focused on your goal setting that it wasn't in tune with your body? Is that what happened? I mean, how can it's just amazing. It's amazing. What did you learn from that then? What did you learn from that experience?
You know, it was a wake up call. It was a wake up call where I realized, so I'll tell you how our life changed. And so, you know, I'm a big believer, and it's so painful. It sucks, right? When you're going through anything like this, no matter what it is. Cause I know every time I tell my story, I have people who come to me and say, you know, I had a podcast host once who said, I've never told anybody outside my family this, but I was recently diagnosed with cancer. And the reason why I'm doing this show is cause I have 6 months to live and I just want to do this.
Yeah.
And so I know so many people are affected by things like this in different ways. We all have these tragedies. And then the question is, what are you going to do about it? Right? What are you going to do? Are you going to go out with a whisper, or are you going to use this for a tremendous opportunity to have an impact and change? Yeah. And for me, it was the latter. I said, okay, well, I'm not going out. I'm not somebody who's going to go out like dying in the ICU, just like forgotten. I'm going to make an impact. And I don't know how much time I have, but in the time that I do have, I am going to do this. And I said, I need to make some changes in our life as well. And so I'm healthier now than I've ever been in my entire life. I work out for the first time after coming out. I decided I was going to hire a trainer. I was going to make the financial sacrifice to work with a physical trainer to ensure that I got into the gym every single week on a regular schedule. So I do that. I decided to completely change my diet. So I start my day every single day. I don't have it in front of me because we're at midday with a green juice, freshly squeezed green juice at home. I eat three fresh smoothies, super low glycemic smoothies. I eat two salads a day and a high quality protein. And I eat like that every single day. And I'm fueling my body with the absolute best food possible. And at the same time, I've helped inspire our entire family to make changes like that. I have an uncle in Canada who is a type 2 diabetic, and he's a great uncle, so he's in his 70s, and he's a little overweight. And he saw what I had done, how I had reduced the amount of insulin I need to take every single day to a fraction of what it otherwise was just by changing my diet and exercise. He was inspired. Yeah. He loses over 75 pounds adopting the same diet that I have. He's 78 years old, 79 years old now, and he kayaks 5 miles every single day, chops wood. He lives in north, you know, in Canada. And he's, and you look at him and you, same person, lost all this weight, and he has more energy than most 30-year-olds that I know. And then he told his friend, and his friend adopted the same diet as him. And now his friend, their buddies, they're doing the same thing. It's this amazing ripple effect that can happen. And this isn't even my focus in life. This is just, I made these changes for me personally. And so the question is, if tragedy strikes in your life, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to make a difference? And for me, I had to take inventory on what is it that I, what's my zone of genius? What is my unique ability? Where can I have the biggest impact in the world? And for me, and as corny as this sounds, it's using the ask formula. This is something that requires a very specific type of mind in order to execute and to develop and to create. And I decided that this cannot be my secret family recipe. This can't be the thing that I secretly hang on to, which has made me all this money and made a few select clients money. This is something that the entire world needs to know about, because it could profoundly change the way that business is conducted online forever. And so I decided, reluctantly, originally, to just share the secret family recipe in the book. It would be like Coca-Cola saying, we're publishing a book and we're telling you exactly how we do it. And that's effectively what I've done. And it was uncomfortable. I'll be perfectly honest. I was nervous because I thought, well, what if people steal my ideas and steal my process? And I said, no, this is bigger than that.
Yes.
This can affect so many more lives and the lives of those people's customers in a profoundly positive way. It has to get out there.
That's what took us
to where we are today.
That's what makes sense of the tragedy, right? Because without that pain and that growth within, you wouldn't be thinking like this today. You wouldn't be thinking of a bigger picture. You'd be thinking of the moment where you're happy and everything's fine and there's no growth occurring. So, you know, Ryan, I was 13 years old. I was really into books, right? And I read one really, really important quote by a mystic of the 12th century called Rumi. And it stuck with me for life, right? He said that everyone's made for a particular work and desire for that work is put into your hearts. And it's up to you to find that out. So if you're not moving through life and you're at a standstill where a lot of people are just dead people walking, right? Things happen in your life to wake you up, to move you towards that purpose. Is that correct?
I think that's a really profound way of looking at it. Yeah.
So it moves you to wake you up to the reason why you're here, because you're not here by accident. There's obviously a purpose that you have to fulfill. And you're living your purpose right now.
I believe so. I think it's we're on the path, and I don't know what the end outcome is, but I think we're on the right path. I think I'm on the right path right now, and being on the show is part of that. So I'm just really thankful that you invited me back.
It's absolutely all right, Ryan. We've got about 8 minutes left. I know you have to go on the hour, but can we talk a little? Can we take a couple of questions?
Absolutely.
If we can kind of talk a little bit about the book, what are people going to gain from that book? And
okay.
People are struggling with understanding, if they're list building and things like that, they've got services to sell, but they don't really know how to get it to their audience in the right way. Can we kind of just highlight a little bit of information there?
Absolutely. So, okay, first part of the question, the book, I'll talk about it at a high level, and then I'll answer the question about how the process in the book can help you if you're looking to build your list, if you're looking to get some traction in your business.
Yeah.
So the book is really broken down into two parts. The first third of the book is a little bit of my story, which we talked about today, on how I arrived at creating this ask formula, how it arrived. And I don't want to give the impression that it's something that I created on my own, because I truly believe we all stand on the shoulders of giants. And I've had some mentors, Dr. Glenn Livingston, for example, who wrote the foreword of the book, who had a profound impact on me personally. And there are others mentioned in the book as well. So it is truly a progression. First part of the book is that story. That gives you the context of how we arrived at where we are today. And just to provide with that, to provide a little context, we're in a place now where across all the markets that I'm in our company, we're generating over 52,000 leads per day.
Right.
Across all, so to put that's 19 million leads per year. Right. So in terms of list building, we have something that is worth paying attention to. So how do you apply that? What's the secret? Well, the secret, again, goes back to talking about the story about learning Chinese, talking about the story of working three jobs. The only thing I've ever known how to do is to do what other people are not willing to do.
Right.
And this process is predicated on a very, very simple concept.
Yes.
And it's this. In a world where everybody is trying to provide a one-size-fits-all answer to everybody in the market, we take a step back. And essentially what we say is this. Whatever market you might be in, listen, one-size-fits-all answer isn't right. But before I can recommend the best approach for you, I need to know a little bit more about your background, your situation, who you are, what you're looking to achieve. So, if you could take a moment to answer a few simple multiple choice questions before I ask you to opt in, tell me a little bit about your situation. With that information, I can customize what I give to you.
Yes.
That, what I just described in a nutshell, is at a 30,000 foot view, that is the secret to this process. It's taking that step back, asking a few thoughtful questions, and using that information to customize both your marketing and the products that you recommend based on where someone is right now in their life.
Excellent. And no one really does that. That's why it's so spectacular, right? It's doing something different from what the majority are doing, which is absolutely fantastic. Right, Ryan, if you forgive me, I know we're very short on time. I'm just going to take some fire kind of questions because they're all dream chasers and I have to give them love. So, okay, asking questions. Is there anything, is there an intelligent way of asking questions or a dumb way? Thank you, Linda, for asking that. So intelligent versus dumb questions. So, you know, you've got that opportunity of probably a few seconds with that, you know, prospect. Is there any way, can you tell me what kind of questions to avoid?
So the counterintuitive part of the whole process is to find out what someone wants, you cannot directly ask them what they want.
Yes.
People don't know what they want. And Steve Jobs has been famous of saying that focus groups are worthless because people don't know what they want until they've seen it.
Yes.
So what you need to ask is questions around, what is your single biggest challenge? What is it that you don't like about XYZ? What are you struggling with right now? People can describe that to you. If you ask someone, what does your perfect day look like? People will invent something because we don't have a really good capacity in our minds to be able to identify what that is. But if I asked you, if you could change something about yesterday, what was one thing that really bugged you?
Excellent.
You can answer that question really accurately. And that, as entrepreneurs, is the raw material that we use to think, what's a solution that we might be able to come up with to solve that particular problem?
Right, excellent. And is it kind of using that kind of ideology where you put the idea into someone's head and think it's their idea?
you can definitely do an element of that for sure.
Absolutely. I love that. I want to learn more about that. Excellent. Okay, so let's just kind of have a look at these email questions. Okay, let me find a suitable one, guys. You're just crazy when you ask you hold on. Right, so do I need to learn copywriting to survey? Is that something that's necessary?
It is valuable. So if there of all the skills that you can learn, writing copy, communicating in a way that's persuasive, I think is one of the most valuable skills that you can develop because it'll never go out of style. right? Facebook may or may not be around in 10 years, just like MySpace disappeared, or it might change. So learning Facebook advertising is something you're always gonna have to keep up with. But writing copy, using language to persuade, to move, to inspire people into action, there is almost nothing more powerful, in my opinion, than mastering that skill. So for me, I've spent a tremendous amount of time studying that art, and anybody who's interested in doing well in business, I encourage to do that as well. So it's not a requisite, and if you just pick up a copy of the book walks through some specific language patterns that you can use as templates when you're surveying, so you can just kind of swipe. But at the end of the day, if you really want to be successful in a massive way in business, then it's a skill that you can't go wrong spending time learning.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, well, guys, the other questions that are coming in a bit more technical. So I'm going to tell you about my class with Ryan. Okay, we went through a lot of detail, and there's also software that I want to introduce you guys to as well. So I'll add that to the show. Ryan, I'm not going to kind of disturb you right now with the technical side of things because we covered a lot in the class.
Okay.
So just overall, Ryan, let's just kind of talk about is it important to get on the phone? I mean, can we lead a laptop lifestyle? Do we really need to get on the phone and talk to these people where we can just communicate through email?
Right. So it's a super question. And it goes again in that category of ask yourself, what is your competitor not willing to do? Right? What makes you uncomfortable? If it makes you uncomfortable, it's making your competitor uncomfortable. And one of the things, again, that's super valuable is actually just get on the phone and have a conversation with your prospective customers and ask them, say, hey, you filled out this survey, you told me your biggest challenge is this, tell me about that.
Yes.
And it doesn't have to be much more complicated than that. Just get on the phone and say, just let them pour their heart out to you. What's going on? Tell me about what you're going through right now.
A human connection.
Let them talk.
Yeah, have that human connection. Okay, offline marketing. Online's huge, but offline has been ignored for a little while. So can we go back to offline marketing? Can we send surveys out to people offline and go back into the inbox?
Yeah, and I'll be perfectly honest. Most of the work that we do with surveys is online, right? And so it's ideal to get people when they are ideally in heat in terms of solving the specific challenge that they're looking to solve. That's when you're going to get the most valuable, the most rich survey data, right? So someone searches for how to lose weight on Google and you send them to a survey. Well, they're in heat, right? They want to lose weight. Versus if you're sending out a postcard to population in general looking to, you know, do you want to lose weight? Well, it's going to be hit or miss. You're really going to have to hit someone right in order for them to be motivated enough to take the survey. So in my model, and it's not the only model, but in my model, which is where we have the most experience, we predominantly use online surveys to gather our data.
Is it because you can reach more people then? Leverage.
You can definitely reach more people. You can reach more people less expensively. Yes. You can do it fast, right? You can do it really fast. You can send an email out to 50,000 people and you could get survey responses in a matter of seconds, right? With a postcard campaign, it's going to take more time.
Excellent, excellent. And a last question, Ryan, for you, the magical question of data. Marketers don't understand how important and crucial data collecting is. So staying in a strategy long enough to collect enough data to analyze and make decisions on, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How important is that as a skill for a marketer to learn?
I think I'll answer it like this. If you look at the largest company in the world, at any one time is a really good indication of what resource is most valuable in the world at that time.
Yes.
So in the second half of the 20th century, it was a company like ExxonMobil. So the most valuable commodity or resource was what? Fossil fuel. And then it became Walmart, right? Walmart became the most successful, the largest company in the world. And what does that mean? Well, it means that selling physical goods became the most valuable resource or commodity in the world. And today, who are the largest companies in the world? They're the companies with the most data. They're Apple, Google, Facebook. And so data is now become the most valuable resource. And so the question is, as small business owners, how can we capitalize on that? Well, surveys and the ask formula is one of the most effective ways that you can do that. If you don't have the resources of Amazon or Apple or for Google. And that's why I'm such a proponent of this. This is why I'm shouting it from the mountaintops. And what's cool about this is something that no matter how small your business is, that you can start using this process today.
Excellent. And it's inexpensive as well, which is a Well, guys, thank you so much, Ryan. Oh my goodness, I can't thank you enough. If I could through the screen, I'll give you a huge hug. But Ryan has very, very kindly given an amazing bonus for Dream Show viewers. So you can actually get the book free, guys, right? So you can look at the details below, click the link, and put Dream Show. I think I have a Dream Show in the promo code as a promo code, and you actually get it for free. And I think it's only shipping or something to have to pay for, right?
We get the books for free. We'll just ask you to cover the shipping costs, and we'll ship a physical copy to you. And if it turns out that you want to, and I think that's a tremendous deal. And if you decide that you're saying, well, you know, I don't even know if I want to risk the cost of shipping. Is it really for me? We even have a free digital excerpt of the book that you can just download totally for free. So you've got two options. You can get the free digital excerpt, or you can get a free full copy of the book, and we'll just ask you to cover the cost.
Mine's on my way, so I always say physical book because it's always there in front of you, right?
Yep.
So that's brilliant. Excellent. Well, Ryan, as you are, okay, last two questions. If you were asked something, okay, the vision of the show is for the people that are listening to create, to pick up one thing that they can create a change in their personal and business life that can transcend to generations, right? So that one change they're looking for, if someone was to ask you that, Ryan, on the street, you know, what is that one thing that you can recommend to someone that will transcend to generations? What would that be?
Whew, gosh, that's a really, really tough question. I think the answer would be to develop a deep relationship with your customers, to understand your customers and understand what their needs, wants, and desires are better than anybody else. And that's something that will transcend generations. That's something that'll be applicable 20 years from now, 200 years from now. As long as human beings are in the current state that we're in, it will be applicable. So I would say that, and a fantastic way to do that is to simply ask questions. And that's why, you know, asking is so important.
And caring and that compassion that comes with it. So that's what develops those skills, right? So and you are on the I Have a Dream Show. Can I ask you, Ryan, to share your dream with my lovely dream chasers to inspire them with incredible minds like yours?
Sure. I mean, my vision is simple. And the reason why we publish this book is simple, and I say it in the book, is that I truly believe that every homepage in the world should have a survey funnel, where you're asking a series of questions before you put people in one of several directions. My vision is that someday we'll wake up and that will be commonplace online. Every business will have that. So that being said, that's my vision.
I love that. I absolutely love that. Thank you so much, Ryan, for gracing us with your presence on the show and giving some tremendous, it's contributing literally a tremendous value in form of knowledge. But if you measure it in the material world, it's like gold and diamonds, honestly. So it's just amazing. Guys, you know, we're going over the hour, but I'm going to wrap this up really quickly. Dream big, guys. You know, go over this replay again. You know, make sure that you get into the really golden nugget parts of it and really think about things. You know, think again. You know, create those ideas and, you know, really dwell on things as well, because it comes out with some really good answers that you need in your life for both personal and business. And go through the university as well, which will be straight after this show, and connect with Ryan too. And you know, I'll tell you more about the group I'm in as well, so you'll see exactly what I'm exposed to. And hopefully Ryan will accept you too to join that magical group. But dream big, guys. Take massive action so I can bring you onto the I Have a Dream Show one day and share your dream with the world. Thank you so much for tuning in, and have a fabulous, fabulous weekend. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye, Princess.
Hey, it's Princess Fizz again. I hope you found this show extremely, extremely valuable. Do like and comment and leave a review for this show. And don't forget to subscribe and share with your friends, whoever it will benefit. Go to ihaveadreamshow.com/shows if you want to watch the video recording of this show. And leave a comment, write to me. I'd love to hear from my listeners about any suggestions, any takeaways that you had, any suggestions for improvements, and make sure that you sign up to the newsletter as well so you don't miss another episode and you get notified by email. I love you loads. Dream big, chase those dreams, make them a reality so I can bring you onto the I Have a Dream show and share your unique journey with the world.